Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we got a packed agenda today. So we're going to move through it like a hot knife through butter, but it's going to mean a whole lot by the time we come back out at the back end. Towards the back end, we'll be talking with Bobby Matos. Bobby Matos is a percussionist, composer, arranger, bandleader, and a representative of the group Grammy Watch, which was formed to fight the recent decision by the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences to cut 31 award categories, including those for Latin jazz, Native American, Hawaiian, and contemporary jazz. Just an outright, really an outrageous offense. Before that, we'll be talking with Gabriela Valle from the California Latinas Reproductive Justice and Norbese Flint from Trust Black Women about the anti-abortion billboards targeting Latinas in Los Angeles. And before that, we're going to open up the show with Lee Ernesto. Lee's a journalist with Revolution Newspaper, and she's joining us to speak on the recent U.S. Supreme Court's ruling that prison conditions in California constitute cruel and unusual punishment. And the court ordered the state to reduce its prison population of 140,000 by 30,000 people. Lee, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to talk with you, Michael.
You too. Well, let's jump into this Supreme Court decision. I think, you know, a lot of people, you know, when it came down, a lot of people were kind of like, whoa, what is this? Where did this come from? Even checking out what the decision actually was, tell people what the Supreme Court decision was.
Well, I think it's important to see what this is and also what it isn't. This case, which was Brown versus Plata, grew out of two class action suits. One of them goes back to as early as 1990, which was filed by seriously mentally ill prisoners. And the other was a year later that came from prisoners with acute medical conditions. So this has been working its way up through the courts and now all the way up to the Supreme Court, which has now upheld a ruling in 2009 by a panel of three federal judges that ordered California to reduce its prison population. So they upheld that ruling. Now, one thing is that the court was very, very split on this, and it was very acrimonious. It was a 5-4 decision, and Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote the majority opinion, while two extremely conservative judges, Scalia and Alito, wrote dissenting opinions, and we can talk a little bit more about that later. But one thing that is important to understand is that they ordered California to reduce its prison population, of which is currently 140,000, by 30,000 people. And immediately there was this big outcry in the press from more conservative forces that, oh my God, they're going to be releasing all these criminals into the, you know, it's more of this kind of hype, and a lot of it has this very blatant racist tinge to it. But one thing is that the opinion itself actually gives the state of California both 2 years to comply, and then after that they may ask for more time. But also, it's the reduction in the prison population doesn't have to be achieved solely by releasing prisoners. For instance, they could actually just build new prisons. They can transfer prisoners out of state or use county facilities. So this is one of the things that is part of the decision that came down. But it is very significant. I mean, it's not every day that you have a Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, that's delivering a decision that not only admits that prison conditions in the most populous state in the U.S. actually constitute cruel and unusual punishment, but if you go through and read the actual majority opinion, it's full of very stark and vivid examples of the kind of cruel and unusual punishment that's going on in the California prison system.
Well, let's get into this, because, you know, one of the things is that it really is true that building prisons is sort of a boom industry in California. I think they've built, like, this massive network of prisons all throughout the state, and you know, they built 23 prisons just, you know, in a very short period of time. They have this huge network of prisons, and then they are, when you think about it, they really do comprise some of the most brutal conditions imaginable. And it is very heavy that the Supreme Court would say cruel and unusual punishment, which actually, in fact, is defining it as unconstitutional, what's going on in the California prisons. Let's talk about what the conditions actually are. Give people a sense of what the conditions that prisoners are living under are.
Well, one of the things is that they, I mean, for many, many years, prison rights activists and prisoners themselves have been writing about the conditions there. And also, there have been lots and lots of litigations against this. In some ways, this has been out there, but more and more people actually need to know about this. And there's books like Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, and other books that are actually getting more broadly out there. And we can talk about this a little bit later, but it's actually very important that this story get exposed and that people know about these prison conditions, because this is some of the most brutal, most inhumane, and most torturous things that are being done, and people just, by and large, don't know about it. Now, the Supreme Court decision, actually, the majority opinion talks about how, with regard to, I mean, here you have mentally ill patients, and the Supreme Court, I mean, this is one of the starkest things, I guess, you know, you could say that a picture is worth a thousand words, but the majority opinion itself actually includes at least two photographs, and I saw, you know, you can go online and look at these photographs, but one of the photographs is a photo of these four cages, okay, and they're like, I don't know, people know like these cages that you put dogs in when you're, I mean, they're like that, right? Except they don't actually even have that many bars. There's like a teeny little window that you can see. And they put mentally ill patients in these cages because they don't have enough room for them. And there's one photo where you see the prisoner inside the cage and he can't even stand up. His head is pressing against the top of his cage. And there's stories about how prisoners are left in there. These are mentally ill patients who actually need health care. They shouldn't be in prison to begin with, but then they're being subjected to this extremely cruel punishment. They're left in there. They don't have any toilet facilities. And this is just one of the aspects of it. And then there's the question of medical or so-called medical care, where people are, first of all, when they go, if they do get to see a doctor or nurse, sometimes they're chained to the floor for their while they're being examined. But the most horrible thing is that they just don't get medical care. And the Supreme Court decision actually mentions at least three different cases in which people died because of lack of medical care. One was a prisoner with severe abdominal pain who died after a five-week delay in being referred to a specialist. Another was a prisoner who was having constant and extreme chest pain, and he also died after an 8-hour delay of seeing a doctor. I mean, I don't know for sure, but, you know, if you're having a heart attack and you don't see a doctor for 8 hours, good chance you're going to die. And there was another case of a prisoner who died of testicular cancer. He didn't get any care for this for 17 months. So, you know, now the one other thing that I think is just very stark, is, and this is all in the Supreme Court decision, right, that Kennedy, the Judge Kennedy, includes in this majority report that suicide rates in the California prisons have been 80% higher than the average for prisons nationwide. Mm. And this is a quote from the actual majority opinion. It is an uncontested fact that an inmate in one of California's prisons needlessly dies every 6 or 7 days due to constitutional deficiencies. And this is the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, admitting and giving evidence to this. And I just want to say one thing here is it's, there is a very ironic side to this, because the Supreme Court and the whole judicial system has actually played a huge role, and we can talk about this, to begin with, of putting people in prison, you know, of passing mandatory sentencing laws, of upholding three strikes you're out laws and all these kinds of things. So there is an ironic side to this, that now you come back around and the courts are actually saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, there's cruel and unusual punishment going on.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Leah Nesto, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about her article, Cruel and Unusual Punishment in California Prisons, which is on the Supreme Court ruling that California prisons are, in fact, unconstitutional, and that they have conditions that are unconstitutional, and the court has ordered California to dramatically reduce its prison populations, not by half, of course, but by 30,000 people. So it would leave them still with 110,000 and growing, okay? And we figure out where it's going to go from there. Now, Lee, one of the things, you know, that's also really very interesting in this is the very system that there's quite a few of these SHU units, these secured housing units in the California prison system. And those SHU units are things that there's now a chain of them that stretch across the country. And, you know, I talked with Lance Tapley, who writes on prisons, a couple months ago, and he was talking about when he examined this, the existence of this whole SHU system, this whole high security prison system, that this is something that's unparalleled in history. And it's really something that not even, you know, nowhere before did they actually produce these kinds of prisons, which in themselves are just cauldrons of torture. They're boxes that people are put in to be squeezed to death. And it's metaphorically, but it's really a very intense thing that to think about even there in the California systems beyond the medical care. The thing that actually leads people to a lot of mental illness is the conditions that people face in these SHU units.
Well, I think one of the things is when you look at this, you have to say, you know, what is driving all this? And not just driving the, you know, putting people in prison, but the way that they treat people once they're in prison, you know. because I, you know, when I was reading and doing research on this, you see that even though it was never the case that prisons, you know, were really about rehabilitation, there was kind of a pretense, you know, that prisoners could, you know, would be rehabilitated, and even some of, you know, the programs were called rehabilitation. But coinciding with the war on drugs, and I would really like to actually talk a little bit about that, but coinciding with the onset of the war on drugs back in the, you know, 30, 35 years ago, they just got rid of any pretense of rehabilitation. You know, there was no, you know, and this goes along with cutting back any programs for giving people skills, educational skills. If you look at the prison system today, and I think these SHU units are very much a concentration, it's just simply about punishment. It's about, if you're not mentally ill, it's about driving you to be mentally ill. It's about punishing you. It's about degrading you. And it's about dehumanizing you and then justifying this broadly in society by saying that you are such a criminal that you can't be rehabilitated. And I think what's important to see about this, it's not a coincidence that this coincided with the onset of the war on drugs. And I just want to bring up one very important point in my article in Revolution Newspaper, where it talks about how it brings up this quote from Nixon. And this is like after the 1960s, the time of urban rebellions and prison rebellions and the Black Panther Party and the anti-war movement. And this gives you a certain sense of what the mindset was of people like Nixon, where one of his top aides later wrote that in his diary that was published. And this is what it said. This is a quote. It says, Nixon emphasized that you have to face the fact that the whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to. I think this last part, devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to. This, in essence, is what the war on drugs was about. It was not about actually, you know, addressing a problem of drugs, which actually, if you look at it, crime rates and drug rates were not screamingly high then. But it was about dealing with what Nixon termed the problem of black people. And if you look at it, you know, you look at the war on drugs. I mean, here's just a quick, really, couple of statistics. Convictions for drug offenses have been the single most important cause of the boom in mass incarceration, which went from 500,000 in 1980 to over 2.3 million today. And drug offenses alone account for two-thirds of the rise in the federal inmate population and more than half of the rise in state prisons between 1985 and 2000. And this is really an amazing statistic. More than 31 million people have been arrested for drug offenses since the war on drugs. And then there's the huge racial disparities, and, you know, there's lots of statistics about this, but this is one of them, is that although the majority of illegal drug users and dealers nationwide are white, three-fourths of all people in prison for drug offenses have been black or Latino. So, I mean, this is like, you really see a whole picture starts coming together here of what the war on drugs was about, what this boom in the prison population was about, and why these prisons are so inhumane, and where you know, a whole section of society is basically being warehoused and tortured and dehumanized, and then broadly in public, this is all being very much broadly justified.
A quick reminder, we're talking with Leah Nesta, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, about her article, Cruel and Unusual Punishment in California Prisons, and that's about the Supreme Court ruling that California prisons were comprised cruel and unusual punishment and ordering the state to reduce its prison population. Now, Lee, one of the things that when you're talking about the war on drugs, it really did strike me too, is that there was a statistic I read somewhere, and I can't remember whether it was in Revolution or somewhere, or maybe in Michelle Alexander's book, about there are more black people in jail today than there were as slaves before the Civil War, which kind of also adds to that. I mean, it's just adding on to this thing that you're talking about. And even there, she talks about the idea of this drug wars thing being really this whole campaign to do exactly what you're talking about, you know, to deal with the so-called problem with black people. You know, one of the things that's really, and she points out there in doing that, she points out that, you know, that this whole thing has, it's not just what happens to people in terms of going to prison, but that sets them on a path for the rest of their life that puts them into a pariah class in a society at large and actually creates a, you know, a constant in and out where it becomes part of the process of life is prison. And one of the things that you talked about in your article, which really got me, was the fact that the Supreme Court said that, you know, when they go back to this idea of the terrible conditions in the prisons, and they tend to blame it on, they base their entire decision on the simple matter of overcrowding. And you talk about the fact that you do not think that overcrowding is the source of the problem. Can you explain what you're talking about there?
Well, I mean, it is. If you carefully read the Supreme Court decision, even though it does have all, or while it has all these exposures, it says that it rests on the assumption that overcrowding is the major reason behind these abuses. And, you know, number one, you do have to say that the way prisoners are jam-packed together is by itself inhumane. I mean, you see these pictures. I mean, people are, you know, there's pictures of you know, basically huge gyms where beds are just, you know, there's hardly room to even walk between the beds, you know. And again, you know, here you have a situation where mentally ill patients are being kept in cages because there's no place to put them. So that in and by itself is inhumane. But this systematic brutalization of prisoners goes way beyond the problem of prisons being overcrowded. Just being overcrowded doesn't explain why prisoners are being subjected, for instance, in the SHU, to this kind of sensory deprivation, you know, where they're not allowed to have any human contact, you know, where they're prevented from even having taking a picture of themselves and sending it to their family. They're allowed like one phone call a week, you know, and it's really a whole system that's meant to break you down, to dehumanize you, to degrade you. Now that isn't explained by overcrowding, and I think more you have to go back and look at what I was talking to you earlier about, like, the role that the whole war on drugs and the role that the prison system is playing in as the system, the government's response to in very intense social and political contradictions that it's faced over the last 30 years. I mean, you know, this is a much bigger topic, and I really would, you know, encourage people to read Michelle Alexander's book, because she actually talks about this whole last four decades or so of how this came about, you know. But you see that things like globalization, the unemployment rates, the fact that these inner-city Black and Latino communities have been allowed to, you know, the factories have left, you know, and there's, you know, very, very intense contradictions, that the system's way of addressing this is with, you know, stop and frisk on the street where thousands and thousands of people are, like, stopped and frisked and targeted, and imprisoning huge sections of people that they see as a very volatile part of society that they need to control.
You know, it's to me, there's something that's, I don't know, it's just really, well, actually, let me make this statistics misquoted earlier, that I miscited earlier, and that is that there actually is more Black men in prison, jail, on parole, or on probation than there were slaves in 1850. A very, very powerful assessment of, you know, compare and contrast what's going on today, and then really, really remarkable statistic. You know, it's very heavy, because you're talking about all this, and you're talking about where what this comes from, and how this is all drenched in white supremacy and the need to control Black people, and all this other, this very volatile section of the population, and you're looking at some very, very severe conditions that are on the face of it. I mean, no one has to, all you have to do, and this is, the conditions exist, and it's remarkable that there's so little that's actually known about what the real conditions in the prison are, and it's always so shocking when people get these things. You know, there was a Laura Magnani, who works for the American Friends Service Committee, did a whole booklet on the conditions of people in these prisons,
right.
And there was also a series in the Sacramento Bee that talked about the terrible, terrible conditions in the High Desert prison, and it was really remarkable when you look at this. There were people in the High Desert prison. There was one man who was stripped naked, who was chained, shackled, hands to his waist to his legs, his ankles shackled together, and he was forced to walk naked down the cell blocks through the prison to an isolation unit. And he, you know, everyone who, and it was not just for him to humiliate him, but it was to actually represent to people, to the other prisoners, this is no different than slavery. And so many of them said that it just reminded them immediately, this picture of slavery. And these are things that go on day in and day out. I mean, Laura talks about, I had her on the show a couple months ago, and she talked about how men, grown men, are forced in isolation to sit in diapers for weeks at a time. Imagine that, just the purpose of the humiliation behind that. And again, to get at what's the cause, why do they do this? It's, yes, there are a lot of sadistic, sick people, you know, running the prisons and guards in the prisons and whatnot, but there's actually a much bigger purpose to this. I think that really is important, an important point that you make in your article and you're making now.
Well, I think that, you know, the other really, really important point on this is that people who are listening to your show, who have read, you know, Michelle Alexander's book, who do know something about this, there is like a moral responsibility to do something about this. It's not enough to just read about this or listen to this radio show and be outraged. There actually urgently needs to be a mass movement to fight this brutal imprisonment of millions of people. And, you know, there are a lot of prison activists and a lot of people very dedicated to doing work around this, and including ex-prisoners and lawyers and all kinds of people. But there really needs to be a mass movement. I mean, I don't know if probably a lot of your listeners saw the excellent documentary on the Freedom Riders. But here you had a very small number of people, which then turned into a large mass movement, of people who just said, this is intolerable. The Jim Crow in the South is intolerable, and we're going to put our lives on the line to stop this. And when this began to be splashed across the front pages of the newspapers, both here and around the world, this actually forced the U.S. government to do something about this. And, you know, you see that, you know, like the Supreme Court decision around the prison thing, is that really going to happen? I mean, there was a Supreme Court decisions have been made around inhumane prison conditions, including about Pelican Bay more than 10 years ago, but the conditions still remain. And the lesson of history is that unless and until there is a mass movement that actually is fighting in a determined and uncompromising struggle around this, the U.S. ruling class won't feel any compulsion to address any of the horrendous problems that this recent Supreme Court decision speaks to. So I think that this is really requires people to think deeply about, you know, their moral responsibility to actually build a mass and determined movement to put an end to this, you know, just intolerable, horrendous situation.
Well, let me jump in here with a quick question that I think is related to this, but it takes it off in a little bit of a different direction. When you're talking about these Supreme Court decisions that have been made before, you know, it's interesting because you begin to talk in your article about it's very difficult right now to see, to actually accurately assess what exactly was behind the Supreme Court making this decision. But you talk about some of the things that you began to talk about in terms of the Freedom Riders and how these decisions actually were made at different times and then years later, you know, then finally through mass struggle, mass public opinion, all this other stuff being generated, that they were forced to actually implement some of the decisions that they made, you know, Brown versus the Board of Education, all these things. You also talk about that Scalia's dissent, that the dissenting opinions in this case actually sheds a little bit of light on what's going on too. Can you talk about those two things?
Well, I think there is. I mean, this is going to take more analysis and understanding of this, but it seems to me that I think that at least part of what is behind this very sharp split, or what appears to be a sharp split on this, is how to deal with an increasing necessity of the U.S. to deal with the fact that not only is the USA number one in mass incarceration, but it's widely known both here and around the world. I mean, the US has 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the prisoners in the world. And here you have the US, which portrays itself as a land of equality, a colorblind society, and all this. Yet African Americans and Latinos are incarcerated at rates far higher than that of whites. And actually, there's an interesting op-ed piece by Clinton, of all people, in the New York Times that talks about how, you know, he's responding to some of these global international organizations that are condemning the war on drugs and condemning incarceration in the U.S. And when I was doing research on this, I talked to this one person who was actually very deeply involved in the struggle around civil rights. And I was asking him about the international dimension of this. And he says, well, you know, he says he thought that there was something to that. He says during the civil rights movement, he recalls that people would go to the Soviet Union, and he says, one time someone asked them, and they said, well, you know, your trains don't run on time here. And the response that they got was, yeah, but in your country, black people can't ride on buses, you know, in the front of the bus. So this was something that, you know, on an international level was being very broadly exposed about the conditions that black people were facing. You know, you had pictures of dogs attacking black people that were being splashed across, you know, newspapers all over the world. And something similar, but not, you know, is beginning to happen with this mass incarceration in the U.S. And it's presenting the United States with some necessity to figure out how to deal with that.
Well, now that'll take us back to what our final question is. And I do think this point about the need for a commensurate response on the part of the people in this country, it's outrageous when, again, you think of the statistic about what's going on, just the basic fact that there's more African-American adults in prison or jail or probation or on parole than were enslaved in 1850. And then you look at the conditions and what you've been saying about what's behind it. And the idea that, we can sort of close our eyes somehow to this, it's very important that, this kind of, that there is something that develops among the people. And I know that there is, I've gotten, you know, some emails and some notices, some press alerts about things developing inside the prisons as well, you know, where there's actually going to be, been a call for a strike in the Pelican Bay Shoe Unit, you know. And can you talk about a little bit more about how you would see this kind of thing developing, or have you heard anything about this strike?
Well, I have heard about it. But going back to this question of building broad support, I mean, one of the things, I just want to say this because I think it's not exactly like people just hear about it and they're outraged and then they want to do something about it. There's a lot of contention out there and other things that are creating public opinion against doing something about this. And I just want to mention one, which is the kind of whole Bill Cosby line, which says that, you know, no, this war on drugs is really needed, and the people who are in prison only have themselves to blame. You know, now this is a whole discussion that maybe you'll have a discussion about this on your show sometime, but this has actually also blinded people to the, you know, there's a lot of people who have mixed feelings about these prisoners, you know, and they tend to be very influenced by this very poisonous line that says that the people in prison are there because of their own doing, not because of what the system has done to it, not because of, you know, racism in the system, not because of white supremacy, not because of disparity in the drug laws and the war, whole war on drugs and all that. So I think that's very important to be able to combat that whole view of mass incarceration. And, you know, because that, I think that this movement against this, what's going on in the prisons, has to be very broad. I mean, it's not just, it has to go throughout society, you know, to all different sections of society, different professions, people in the neighborhoods, students, youth, professionals, all kinds of people need to both become aware of this and become active around it.
All right. We've been talking with Leah Nesta, a writer from Revolution Newspaper, and we've been talking about her article, Cruel and Unusual Punishment in California Prisons. It's about the Supreme Court ruling around the California prisons and ordering, saying that they were, they consist of cruel and unusual punishment and ordering them to dramatically reduce the number of prisoners they're holding.
Can I just give a plug for, if people go up to revcon.us, which is the website of Revolution Newspaper, there's a special issue that we did on prisons, which I would really encourage people to read.
You read my mind. That's exactly where I was going to go. And you can also, people can also find your article on revcom.us, and I really suggest that people do that. So, Lee, thank you very much, and I imagine the paper will be covering whatever develops inside the Pelican Bay Shoe Unit.
Oh, yeah, we're working on it right now.
Okay, and we'll have you back to talk about that. Lee Ernesto, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thanks, Mike.
All right, take care now. Bye.
All right.
All right, we've been talking with Leah Nesta, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, about the cruel and unusual punishment in California prisons. That's actually what the Supreme Court has ruled and ordered them to dramatically reduce the prison population. You know, I've been thinking about this a lot. New Year's Day 2009 wasn't more than a couple of hours old when Oscar Grant, a 22-year-old black man, was murdered in cold blood by Johannes Meserle, a Bay Area rapid transit cop. Oscar was lying face down on the train platform when Meserle put a bullet in his back. Other train passengers used their phones and cameras to capture the murder on video, and millions more all over the world watched it on YouTube in the weeks and months that followed. Just a short while ago, Johannes Meserle walked out of prison. He walked out of prison free, free and easy, got into a car and drove off to whatever his life is going to be. Oscar Grant was murdered, and millions of people saw the video showing that Oscar Grant was murdered. This cop... What did this cop do? He got hit on the wrist. He got convicted of involuntary manslaughter. Everything was done to grease the skids of that trial to make sure that he could get the lightest possible sentence. This cop spent 11 months in jail, okay, 11 months in jail for cold-blooded murder. And I don't care what they convicted him of. We saw the video. We know what went on, and we know what goes on in society at large and what role these police play. And this cop walked free. There's people doing more time for drunk and disorderly, okay? That's the story of what's going on with this. Now, I want you to think, you know, and all this is occurring at the same time as what we've been talking about, the California prisons and the incarceration rate and the racism, the white supremacy that all this is drenched in. You know, I was thinking about this just recently, because I also noticed, and I've noticed something developing in the society at large, which, you know, we don't have the kind of massive political resistance that we need around a whole lot of issues. But in particular, when something like this is coming up and you look at this and then you hear people talk about, we have to be reasonable about the police. We have to begin to understand. People who should know better talking about, well, it's a tough job. After all, they maintain the thin blue line between our security and our ability, our standard of living, and chaos. And you know what? Those police, yes, there is a thin blue line. And what they do, what they represent, is they represent the fact that that life, that standard of living that American imperialism gives some people in society is based on the fact that the vast majority of people in the world and a whole hell of a lot of people in this society are born into chaos. And the cops are the enforcers of this system that brings that chaos down. And so when you next time you start thinking about, you know, it's time to be reasonable. It's time to think that, okay, you know, it's a tough job, but cops and people, somehow we can work out a happy medium. No, we can't. Oscar Grant is dead. Johannes Messerli walks free. And anytime you're tempted to think about that, I want you to sit down, quick, grab your iPod, grab your stereo, and listen to this song from Gil Scott Heron, Jose Campos Torres.
A poem for Jose Campos Torres. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I had confessed to myself all along, tracer of life, poetry, trends, that awareness, consciousness, poems that screamed of pain and the origins of pain and death had blanketed my tablets, and therefore my friends, brothers, sisters, in-laws, outlaws, and besides, they already knew. But Brother Torres, common ancient bloodline Brother Torres, is dead. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I had said I wasn't going to write no more words down about people kicking us when we're down, about racist dogs that attack us and drive us down, drag us down and beat us down. But the dogs are in the street. The dogs are alive and the terror in our hearts has scarcely diminished. It has scarcely brought us the comfort we suspected. The recognition of our terror and the screaming release of that recognition has not removed the certainty of that knowledge. How could it? Dogs, rabid, foaming with the energy of their brutish ignorance, stride the city streets like robot gunslingers and spread death as night lamps flash crude reflections from gun butts and police shields. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this, but the battlefield has oozed away from the stilted debates of semantics, beyond the questionable flexibility of primal screaming. The reality of our city, jungle streets and their gestapos has become an attack on home, life, family, philosophy, total. It is beyond the question of the advantages of didactic niggerisms. The motherfucking dogs are in the street. In Houston, maybe someone said Mexicans were the new niggers. In L.A., maybe someone said Chicanos were the new niggers. In Frisco, maybe someone said Orientals were the new niggers. Maybe in Philadelphia and North Carolina, they decided they didn't need no new niggers. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this, but the dogs are in the street. It's a turnaround world where things are all too quickly turned around. It was turned around so that right looked wrong. It was turned around so that up looked down. It was turned around so that those who marched in the street with Bibles and signs of peace became enemies of the state and risked to national security, so that those who questioned the operations of those in authority on the principles of justice, liberty, and equality became the vanguard of a communist attack. It became so you couldn't call a spade a motherfucking spade. Brother Torres is dead. The Wilmington 10 are still incarcerated. Ed Davis, Ronald Reagan, James Hunt, and Frank Rizzo are still alive, and the dogs are in the motherfucking street. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I made a mistake.
Gil Scott Heron and Jose Campos Torres. So remember, Oscar Grant is dead, murdered literally in front of millions and millions of eyes. The cop that killed him in cold blood walks free. Enough said. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Gabriela Valle from the California Latinas for Reproductive Justice and Narbese Flint from Trust Black Women, and we'll be talking about the anti-abortion billboards that are going up in Los Angeles attacking Latinas. So stay tuned. Welcome back. You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And that was Bobby Matos with John Santos. And I wanted to make a quick announcement. Unfortunately, we're running over time here, and we are not going to be able to have Bobby Matos on today, but he has been generous with his time, and he's really generous with his beautiful music, and you need to listen to Bobby's latest album, which we will have with us next week. But Bobby will join us next week to talk about what's going on with the this horrendous attack by the Grammy, by the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences, to reduce the number of Grammys given out for Latin jazz, to actually cut them out completely, Latin jazz, Native American, Hawaiian, and contemporary jazz. So Bobby will join us next week. All of you who are tuning in to listen to Bobby, tune in next week, and you'll get to hear him then. We'll have a much more extended chance to talk with him. So that's that. But right now, we are going to move into our discussion with, as I said, Gabriela Valle from California Latinas for Reproductive Justice, and Norbese Flint, who's actually from Black Women for Wellness. Yeah. And they are both, and she's also associated with the Trust Black Women, California. Which is California, which is a sort of an umbrella group kind of thing?
Yes.
Okay, where a lot of people come together to do some very important stuff. So welcome to the show, both of you. Gabriela?
Thank you, Michael. Sure. Thanks for having us on this morning.
Norbese?
Thank you. Okay. Very happy to be here.
Good. You know, one thing I wanted to talk about, you're here because somebody actually sent me a picture of a billboard that is in L.A. And I've actually been I followed this when it was happening with Black women in Georgia and in other parts of the country and in New York, you know, and I saw this and I thought, wow, what the hell is going on here? So, Gabriela, I called you and I thought, let's see. What do you know about this? What do you know about this?
Sure. Last Sunday we had three billboards that came up in Los Angeles. They read, in English they read, "The most dangerous place for a Latino is in the womb." If you'll allow me, I'm going to give the translation in Spanish because it's actually worse. El lugar más peligroso es en... sorry about that. El lugar más peligroso para un Latino es en el vientre de su madre. So any listeners listening who are probably a little bit appalled at this moment, making this a very literal translation, it just came off extra horribly offensive. Immediately, my organization, CLRJ, and our sister organizations throughout Southern California went on the offense to really call these ads out for what they are, as racist and offensive, totally denying a woman's ability to make decisions over herself, for herself and her family. And ultimately, they detract from the true needs in our community, which are actually for more health care, education, opportunities for our communities.
Well, you know, one thing that really strikes me, and basically we will get to you in a minute, but I want to follow this out in the, just in the beginning in terms of the line of thought here. You know, one of the things is that you look at this, and it's really, you know, you look at who's sponsoring this.
Yes.
And this is a group, you know, there's all these groups that appear to be ad hoc groups that all have, you know, they have the Radiance Project and things like this that are all very much linked to Christian fundamentalism.
Yes.
You know, the Christian fascists that are out there, they're linked to these, you know, the Tea Party kind of Republican right wing, the Newt Gingriches, all these people who now apparently, you know, it's a testing line for anybody who wants to be a Republican candidate for president, whether or not you actually, even if you have to change your position immediately, you know, within 24 hours of saying it, it's, you now have to say that you are dead set against abortion and that women should be breeders, basically. That's that's what they're here on the planet for. So just get with it, you know, and that's, and you think about this, it really, to me, there really is this campaign that's designed to, and it's true, all the things you're saying about the racism and everything else in it, but there really is a campaign to deny abortion, abortion rights to women, and to create public opinion that somehow women are doing something terrible in the case of Black people, they have, in the case of Black women, they have announced it as it's, you know, the billboards there talk about genocidal things. And that's the implication in these billboards for speaking to Latinas as well. And they're speaking to more than Black women and Latinas. They're speaking to the overall society. But to really beat this into people's minds that women do not have the right, should not have the right to abortion, and that fundamentally they shouldn't have the right to determine what happens to their own body. That is, they should be slaves. What do you think of that?
Well, there's three organizations behind all of these ads in terms of who the players are and who's paying for all this. It's Latino Partnership for Conservative Principles, who get on the mic and podium and pretend to speak for the whole Latino communities. There's the Radiance Foundation. And then on the ads that came up in Los Angeles, at the very bottom of the right-hand corner was a little flag that read, American Principles in Action. So ultimately, yes, the connection is all three of these organizations putting the money behind the ads, rolling out campaigns that are targeting women of color throughout the country in different states. Like you mentioned, a lot of this started in Georgia. And just this week, a few days ago, our colleagues in the Bay Area just informed us that throughout East Oakland and in the Fruitvale, more attacks came out specifically targeting African-American women. So we know it's just a matter of time for the Latino ads to follow as well. Ultimately, I think you've hit one of the really strong points that these organizations are after, which is for the long-term eradication of Roe. It's a really specific attack on women. And yes, they're, attack on the issue of choice, or we really like to broaden that as reproductive justice advocates. We find choice very limiting as a frame. We really want to constantly encourage people to think about it's a slew of it's a bigger issue, and really the concepts around choices and what it means for women to, in the case of Latinas, given that that's who this billboard attacked, they come out and use, absolutely erroneous numbers. Their method for doing math is interesting, to say the least. The real numbers around math in the state of California is that Latinas are the most uninsured. So, but by the same token, you're going to put out an ad that says that my womb is your battleground. It's the place where you're going to come out and make your political attacks. Latinas, right now, we looked at this ad as one more attack and a slew of attacks on us as women, as immigrants, as workers. That's really the situation we're looking at right now. The last point on this, that this particular ad on its face value is very directly targeting a Latina, saying to her, you can't be trusted. You can't be trusted to make choices in your own community. Now, the irony is that we've heard a few people say that they saw the ad and they thought, is that a weird way of saying that Latinas need more prenatal care? which is ironic, because it's true. Latina immigrant women wait an awfully long time before they seek prenatal care due to lack of insurance, lack of financial ability, lack of support, and ultimately fear sometimes of not knowing what's going to be asked of them when they show up at the clinic. So even in the position of being a Latina who has chosen to keep her pregnancy, but because she's an immigrant and the fear is very real, she ends up postponing even something as important as her prenatal care. So again, it definitely gives us a lot to think about and talk about.
You know, one thing I always thought that we should put up a series of billboards to say that the worst place for a Latino or the worst place for a black person is America. let's just be real about this, because this is absolutely outrageous. Now, I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Gabriela Valle, and I'm going to call you Gabby because that's how you keep introducing yourself to me, and I'm like,
sure.
I'll be informal now. And she's from California Latinas for Reproductive Justice, and Norbese Flint from Black Women for Wellness, and also Trust Black Women California.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Norbese, this whole billboard campaign, as I mentioned earlier, started, I think, in Georgia. And it was a very intense campaign down there. And it's also been then moved to, I saw the most horrendous billboard that they had in New York, in Soho.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a lot of other places where this is going on. Can you talk about that, what the roots of that were, and what those posters were, and how they related to this?
Yes, definitely. So what happened is around, I think, July of last year. Sorry, people, sometimes I speak a little bit low. These billboards popped up in Atlanta, and it just said endangered species and had a little black baby. And so all of us were kind of like, what is this about, right? And then it sent you to this website, right? So we followed the website and found, like, this is whole conspiracy theory about, the genocide of black people. And then from that, there were two legislations actually attached to it, one in the House and one in the Senate. And what they were doing were trying to, and essentially, end abortion rights for women of color, mostly focusing on black women and Asian women. And this had to do with a law that had women, or charged doctors for coercing women of color into having an abortion. So from these billboards, we saw what the really attack was, because there are people who never usually support women's issues, support women of color's issues, all of a sudden saying, hey, we care about you and the survival of your race. Mm-hmm. Let us do this. So we looked at that at face value and saw what they were really trying to do, which is control women's bodies. And this from that, I guess, mecca of the laws, it kind of spread out through the states. So they're in Florida, they are in New York, they've been here in Los Angeles before, and then now they're back in Los Angeles again. They've been in Illinois, Texas, Wisconsin, Missouri, they have spread out pretty far and pretty wide. Some have the endangered species, some the black and unwanted, some is the most dangerous place in the world. Even one with Obama's face on it, mm-hmm. which said, you know, every 21 minutes somebody's aborting their next leader. Mm-hmm. So they're pretty offensive. So from that, there was a group of women in Atlanta who decided that we need to get together and we need to talk about this, and this is an attack on our on us. So, and that's how Trust Black Women formed, and that was a group of RJ Black women who are from RJ groups and allies came together, and really it was just like, how can we combat this attack on us, right? And so from that, we all kind of, because we're all from different parts of the country, we all kind of went back to our states and tried to figure out how can we in our state prepare our state if they haven't came here yet, and really, if it has, really kind of defend and protect women, right? And tell our stories the way we want and tell what is the issue that's going on. And so in California, we kind of did the Trust Black Women California. And that's a group of women of color from organizations all up and down California who are, you know, offended, but also have been working on issues that with women's health for years, decades, and really can say something and really are in the community doing work and feel like this is our time to shine. And this is what, and tell the truth about what these attacks on us really are.
And when you mentioned, just to real quick clarify something very quick, when you said RJ groups, you were talking about reproductive justice groups. That's all right. Don't worry about it. That's what I'm here for. My whole job is to just catch things like that and fill it in.
Yes, because the other RJ work, which is really important to us, is racial justice work. So,
And there is a certain coincidence there when you're talking about
this. Absolutely connected. Mm-hmm. You can't separate it out.
Now, Gabby, you know, you look at this and in particular, and I think, you know, we were talking about this earlier, and we can just touch on this very briefly since we have a little bit more time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's sometimes these groups, and I know that this came up. This is one of the ways they tried to cloud things up, these fascist groups to come out and promote these kinds of anti-abortion and anti-women, you know, billboards and this whole campaign. They try to pick on something that maybe that happened in the past and mm-hmm. did all these other, you know, like here, there's a question of rooted in people's thing of the fact that there were, in fact, forced sterilizations in Los Angeles of women of color. And then in Georgia, there was all the thing about the idea that Planned Parenthood was somehow tied up with eugenics. And this is stuff that really they twist the truth quite mm-hmm. a bit. So I'd ask you to talk about in particular that point. And we can just, you know, you don't have to go deep into it, but you can actually even point people to an understanding of that. It would be helpful because they are trying to scare the hell out of people in terms of what is going on. And they've created a massive campaign around abortion, actually, which mm-hmm. is, you know, a huge. And to me, even the thing about prenatal care and women's health care and all the stuff, the attacks on Planned Parenthood, mm-hmm. it's true that they're attacking the broad, mm-hmm. you know, contraception, everything else. But that is, to me, is a gateway to going after abortion, because that's the fundamental question of whether a woman, in fact, is going to have control and say over her body, mm-hmm. or is she going to be in the same actual condition as a slave? You know, so to me, can you speak to this earlier point, though?
Sure. One of the uniting principles that these three organizations have, among the many others, we're dealing with the three who've paid for these ads, is that they have a very one-track mind about. They're both short, intermediate, and long-term goal is to put Planned Parenthood out of business. And we've seen them try this over the decades. Their most current incarnation of attacking any clinics who are abortion providers. But in this case, it's pretty easy to see. Planned Parenthood is an easy target. They exist all over the country. They have their own, you know, problematic startup because of Margaret Sanger. We're going to put that to the side for a moment, because we won't ignore it. But given that this is the track that they're on, they continue to skew the facts of even what it is that providers actually are doing for communities. So looking at this from a community and women of color perspective, we're over here in the end of, we don't have enough clinics in our communities, period, to meet the needs of what we do have. So that if there is a local Planned Parenthood or other small clinic provider, the reality is that this is where our women are going for cancer screenings, for birth control, for the breast cancer exams, for annual checkups for STDs and STIs. CLRJ works a lot with women in the Central Valley. And in the Central Valley, Planned Parenthood is one of the few clinics where women can access prenatal care. Sometimes not knowing what services are offered there, the women will show up with their kid who's sick. Well, can you at least take the temperature? Because they don't actually have other access other than getting on a bus and maybe going into another clinic that's maybe an hour to an hour and a half away. And this is a bus ride both ways. So we hear these stories every day in the real lives of women, the women that we're working with in various communities. We haven't even touched on the abortion word yet. Why is that? Because like other providers, this is where communities actually get to access just basic care. And from a Latina, from a woman as part of a broader Latina community, our first need is for more health care and for more clinics, for more access. I mean, that's one of the crucial points that CLRJ works with, both in our community education and in our policy, is actually to increase access so that women, men, children have the opportunities to have what they need to make the best informed choices for themselves. The irony about the other side is if they actually pointed to a clinic where it was really proven that some coercive things were happening, here's the greatest irony. Reproductive justice orgs would be all over that, because it is a key value of reproductive justice to work against any coercive measures that don't allow women to make their choices. And that's exactly what happened here in the 1970s. It was mostly Mexicana and Mexican-American women who were targeted for forced sterilizations without their knowing.
That's an extremely important point. Now, for both of you, and I do want to save we have a couple minutes, so maybe we're going to have to actually jump into this, but we should let people know that you came into the studio this morning with some good news, which was, tell them.
Sure. So a press release came out yesterday afternoon from the Latino Partnership for Conservative Principles. Among other things, they whined that activists squelched their free speech and went on and on. And because they said that the activists are trying to cover up that Planned Parenthood is targeting minorities. Again, they have not given up on associating abortion with genocide. And what an absolute insult to the actual histories of peoples in this country to even go there and use that language and try to usurp civil rights language in particular. It's really, really disturbing. If you want to add anything.
Yeah, I also wanted to piggyback on something that you said, and about why these billboards are not just about abortion, is because they sit there and they use pulling our heartstrings and using the history of people in this country, using the history of black women. We see race and we see endangered and we're like, what's going on, right? Mm-hmm. And we see that, but, you know, it's not really telling the whole truths or our truths. And what it is using it as a scapegoat, right, to not address the issues that we already address. But just to put the positive thing is that we got some of those billboards down, right?
Yes.
And we are very excited at this thing because, like, we come to our backyard, right?
Yes. Well, this is important, and I'm going to have to move on because we have about a minute and a half left. Mm-hmm. I got to do a wrap up here,
sure.
But I did want to say this idea of people, you know, all over the country. When you see these billboards, you need to get in touch with people.
Yes.
You need to actually, people need to be paying attention to. These kinds of things cannot be allowed to just go unopposed because they create a certain atmosphere. We were talking earlier, all the stuff that they appeal to, it's designed to create this atmosphere that goes along with a whole much bigger agenda that, as one of my interns on the show this morning was talking about, and I wish we had gotten to this question, but we ran out of time, but the idea of the connection between what's going on with these billboards and a much bigger agenda in society around this. And I think this is an incredibly important point for people to think about. This is not unrelated to those fundamentalist fools, those ministers who talked about when Katrina killed so many black people in New Orleans, they talked about it was God cleaning out the city.
Right, it was awful.
Know? And these are the same people that are now behind these signs talking about, oh, there's genocide going on if you have an abortion. So I want to thank both of you for coming in today. And real quick, Gabby, how can people get in touch with you and your group?
Sure. Let me just give an email. It would make life easier. GABRIELA.CLRJ@gmail.com.
No basic.
And for us, it is bwwla.org. Again, that's B as in boy, wwwla.org. You can hit us up and we'll find you there.
And again, we had three ads taken down today off of the CBS billboard.
All right, let's hear a big loud. Now, I want to hear real loud. I want to hear real lot of applause. Yeah! Yeah, that's good. All right.
You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm the host and producer, Michael Slate.
We've just been talking with Gabby Valle from California Latinas for Reproductive Justice and Norbese Flint from Black Women for Wellness and Trust Black Women California. And we've been talking about what's the truth behind these outrageous billboards attacking Black and Latina women and their right to abortion in many cities throughout the country. I also want to thank my earlier guest, journalist Leonesto from Revolution Newspaper, who joined us to talk about the recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling that declared the conditions in California prisons to be cruel and unusual punishment and ordered the state to dramatically reduce its prison population. You know, and all that brings me back to the backbone of this show, best captured in a quote from Bob Avakian: "The truth will not set us free in and of itself, but we will not get free without the truth." And as I think about that, I'm drawn back to the middle segment of this show. The commentary on the cop who murdered Oscar Grant on January 1st, 2009, going free despite murdering this young Black man. And as I said earlier, we really cannot get shaky on our understanding of what's going on here and why this kind of police brutality and terrorism is somehow acceptable to those who run this society and why it should never be acceptable to us. Again, it's worth checking out a quote from Bob Avakian here. "The role of the police is not to serve and protect the people. It is to serve and protect the system that rules over the people. To enforce the relations of exploitation and oppression, the conditions of poverty, misery, and degradation into which the system has cast people and is determined to keep people in. The law and order the police are about, with all of their brutality and murder, is the law and order that enforces all this oppression and madness." Both of these quotes can be found in Avakian's new book, Basics. You can't change the world without knowing the basics. Check it out. Well, that wraps up our show for this week. I want to thank my engineer, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and my interns, Natalie Martinez and Hannah Malthrop. If you want to write to me, please do. You can send your comments, ideas, criticisms, and suggestions, or just say hi by dropping us a line at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. You know, 35 years ago, on June 16th, Black school kids in the segregated South African township of Soweto took to the streets behind the banner, "For freedom we shall lay down our lives." The police and army of the racist apartheid regime in South Africa killed hundreds that day, but the chants of those school kids bounced off the walls of the tiny matchbook houses in the township and shook the fabric of history, eventually leading to the end of the apartheid regime. We're going to go out now with a song inspired by the Soweto Uprising and the more than decade of rebellion that followed it. This is Soweto from Jeffrey Osborne. Talk to you again next week.
They can't.